Hi everyone, I'm Greg Lowe from Down Under in Australia. Fabric Down Under is a production from SQL Down Under. It covers Microsoft Fabric, a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions and views expressed in the podcast are individual and don't necessarily reflect the opinions and views of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation. Introducing Show 6 with guest Paul Turley. Welcome. Our guest today is Paul Turley. Paul is a long-term data platform MVP and a director of consulting services at 3Cloud, and we're very pleased to have him with us today. So welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Awesome. Now, in this session, what I was really hoping to cover off is some of your experiences so far with starting to look at migrating clients to Fabric and what you think enterprises can and can't do with it so far. So maybe if we just start with, where do you think the product is at right now in terms of usability for enterprises?
Good question. And I think in some ways it's in a pretty good place. Fabric, of course, is built on top of some very mature technologies that have been around for some time, for a number of years. There are other components of the Fabric platform that are brand new. Yeah. Since it's been out as we speak for a little over 2 months now, came out in the middle of November
as part of Ignite.
You know, there are some components that are very new.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, my general feelings about Microsoft Fabric is that, it's a very, very solid platform based on some very deep and mature technologies but the interface is very new. A lot of features are very new. So there's a lot of potential there. As you dip your toe in the water, I think you need to be a little cautious about what you use and make sure that you understand the components that that you're beginning to use.
Yeah.
And so, for example, you know, the One Lake lake houses, that's all based on Azure Storage Gen 2, which is a very, very deep technology and I think very
and
reliable.
Very mature at this point.
And very mature. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Spark engine, of course, Microsoft didn't invent Spark.
No.
It's you know, it comes from the open source community, but also fully baked and very reliable. But the I think Microsoft's adoption of Spark is new, and we're going to see that integration mature more and more.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of this evolved out of Power BI, which is the most popular analytic and reporting tool on the planet. And those components are very, very new as well.
And so, you know,
things
BI
like data pipeline
should point out, still evolving rapidly as well.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And no doubt it will continue to for some time. Microsoft continues to invest pretty heavily. That's been my product for the past 5-6 years or so. Is you know, my focus has been implementing Power BI in for enterprise customers and in ways that it's scalable and secure. And it's really grown up very, very quickly just in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I'd say that's been the majority of our work too over recent years. I mean, we still get involved with other data projects and things like that, but I'd say it's still where the majority of work that we're doing comes from. And it's more, I mean, with most of these projects, it's the integration work, the, you know, the structuring semantic models, you know, it's stuff like that. So
You know, I think if you think about Fabric as kind of the the next phase of Power BI, and it is more than that, but if you look at it from that perspective, from that what they call that experience, you know, Microsoft were challenged about 10 years ago because they had a really solid reporting product.
Yes.
A very, very mature and solid
which we all loved. Yeah, each of these things. Yeah.
Well, and we all being IT professionals.
Hmm.
So, you know, back in the old days, if an organization needed analytic reports, they went to IT and we would stand up a SQL Server database with an analysis services cube and use SSIS to populate it and then use SQL Server reporting services on top of that. And those were not end user tools.
No.
You know, the business had to go to IT and developers would create a reporting solution. But the rest of the industry kind of evolved in a different direction. We had tools like Tableau and Qlik and a number of other tools that were very business focused. And it wasn't
not,
IT.
Not just business, though, too. They also tackled mobile and things like that much earlier on than what happened in the Microsoft stack.
Agreed.
Mm.
So there was there were a few years there where Microsoft were playing catch up in the self-service and business-driven analytics world, and Power BI was initially the answer to that problem, but they quickly caught up and then surpassed competition.
Yeah.
If you look at the Gartner Magic Quadrant, Microsoft is clearly winning that game.
Yeah.
Today, but I think competition spurs them on. There are some other great products out there, but now it's both sides.
Yeah.
Fabric, I think, really is kind of the expansion of the Power BI tool into the mid-market and heading toward the enterprise as well.
Mm. And so in terms of integration work, how much work were you previously doing with, let's say, Data Factory and tools like that? And what's your experience been in terms of starting to move those?
Well, our company is entirely focused on the Azure platform.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been very, very deeply invested in tools like Azure SQL, Azure Data Factory. Mm-hmm. To some degree, Azure Databricks. And so that's been our tool of choice for the most part. Our data and analytics practice have a very rich investment in tools like ADF. With the advent of Fabric now, we're seeing pipelines that essentially have evolved out of ADF and Synapse pipelines.
Yeah.
And so that's very welcome news that you can take those skills with you and essentially do things the same way that you've been doing them in the past, but in a very streamlined sandbox.
Yeah, I think that's one of the challenges is for someone familiar with ADF. I know that I've had customers who just struggle to find things a bit in the Fabric interface. So often those things are there; they're just in different places and.
But then you have people who come from the Spark and Python world, and they're accustomed to using notebooks.
Mm.
And now, you know, with the introduction of Jupyter style notebooks in Fabric, you can do that as well.
Yeah.
And you know, there are things that I think that. Pipelines and that type of data transformation tool that essentially grew out of you remember old DTS and SSIS. I think that's still a tool that's optimized for kind of lift and shift data movement.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas notebooks can be used for deep manipulation. Of course, there's support for data science and for the next generation of data-centric developers who are coming out of college learning Python and Scala.
Yeah,
notebooks are really the tool of choice.
One of the things that's interesting there, if I look at ADF, we tend not to do that much transformation using ADF. We've tended to use it for data movement and for orchestration of things more so than the actual manipulation. So, I mean, for example, we have tended not to use data flows in ADF for doing manipulation, but that might change now in the way they're implemented in Fabric. Because if I look at ADF, the customers I work with never think about the cost of ADF. It never even comes into the equation. But the ones that I've had that have raised issues with the cost of ADF tend to be if they've used data flows or if they've been using the integration services runtime. I mean, they're the two categories of people who go, hey, this thing's expensive. And they're two things that we've tended to avoid.
Interesting. What's very attractive about Fabric is that there are no runaway costs.
No.
I mean, you can set up auto scale where you can kind of open that door a little more, but for the most part you pay for a capacity and you use it.
Yeah.
It's a very predictable cost.
Mm-hmm.
And, when we have scaling features that essentially allow you to exceed spikes.
Yeah.
And, we kind of borrow from the future idle times.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very attractive for our customers to be able to predict their costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's interesting. It's also worth noting the fact that the data flows are basically completely rewritten inside the way they work in Fabric, the engine for that. And so I think it lends itself better to how it works in there.
Mm. Yeah, no doubt. Well, as a Power BI professional, I'm excited to be able to use Dataflows Gen 2, which essentially is, as you say, Power Query sitting on a more powerful engine.
Yeah.
That now has the ability to put data into different stores.
Mm.
So, with Power Query in the past, I mean, Power Query is such a marvelous tool. It's elegant.
It's funny, I often say to people out that if you've been in the industry a long time, it's pretty easy to get jaded when you see new technologies and think, but Power Query is one of the few that, the first time I looked at that, I just thought, that is just awesome. It was like a breath of fresh air, it's just conceptually as to how that would work. Yeah.
Well, and not only, is there a rich user interface and, you could build very rich, complex transformations simply by clicking buttons and using menu options. But it wrote code.
Yes,
it did. And it was object-oriented code where you had classes and methods and functions in M. And if you really wanted to go in and rewrite some of the code yourself, you could do that
too. You could.
That appeals to the developer part of
my
brain.
Actually, that raises a really interesting question. I find that whenever I used to be at product group meetings, I suppose nowadays online too, I'm always the one who finds myself putting a hand up saying, how do I build that? I want to extend things. I want to build, for example, library. I mean, so Power Query is a good example with M. I still wish there was a better way I could just build and distribute libraries of code to go with it and so on. It's so powerful. You can build these things, but there's no great distribution platform for that. And look, it's the same in SQL Server today. I mean, there's no way you can build a library. We have SDU tools, but we install that in a schema in every database where it's used. So there's no concept of, let me go and create a database that holds a library that can then be referenced from the other databases, and so on. There's system libraries, but, they're a very special thing, but it just sort of strikes me as a programming concept. It's just sort of odd that we don't have like a library concept, and the same thing applies to M and so on.
Well, if you're remember back in the day, which I'm sure that you do, you could write custom classes for analysis services.
Yes.
And, you know, and call your own functions. You, mm-hmm. you have to write them in C++ or I don't know if you could write them in C#. I don't know if it supported .NET. I mean, this was way back in the day. But
there were some .NET things, but yes, it's a long time back.
There was that concept, and again, that was a very IT developer,
yep.
you know, centric technology, you know, in that era. And I can just hear the answer from the product teams. You know, we say, hey, why can't we write our own libraries and reference them? You know, I suppose the answer would be, well, a very small population yep. are asking for those capabilities, and we're going to serve the masses first.
Yeah, I think the trick, though, is that it does lend itself then to or lead to people implementing the same thing in different ways in different data flows, for example, and so on, where, yeah, I would love for the more complicated things to have, you know, here is our organization stamped version of that's how you do that calculation. Yeah. So, but anyway, yeah. So look, yeah. extensibility is just one of my things. You know, I just wish it was a more widely available thing. Yeah. However, the fact that you can build functions thing, it's interesting building functions for M and so on. The, because again, just the style of language that it is, like more of a functional language, and that's a bit of a shock to some people when they first start writing it.
Yeah. Alex Powers has blogged and written on building custom functions. And that was one of the things that was very attractive to me when I started using Power Query back in the day was, you know, you could essentially build these custom functions and then call into them. But I quickly learned that if you do that row by row, it doesn't scale.
It doesn't scale. And actually, that was the very next thing that I was going to come to, is that I often have scenarios where I'm choosing between manipulating something in Power Query code or manipulating it in, say, a stored proc in a database. And the database runs rings around it in terms of performance because of, you know, multiprocessor scale. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it's designed to run things like that, where a lot of the Power Query stuff tends to be single threaded. And that doesn't matter to you if it's not very big, but if it is big, that really does matter to you.
Yeah. Well, you know, scalability is key. And since a lot of these capabilities from, you know, the early days of Power BI really were centered around the self-service community, mm-hmm. we're finding that people who don't have that IT background, like yep. we do, who have learned, you know, Power Query and data modeling and report design and Power BI, tend to think they don't think about scale. They think yeah. about solving a business problem, mm-hmm. which is great that there is a tool that does that. My focus has largely been around designing solutions that will scale.
Yeah.
And you have to think about using a set-based operation or mm-hmm. maybe pushing a transformation back up into the database, rather than doing it within the tool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it may work great on 100,000 rows, but it doesn't really work well on 10 billion
yeah,
rows.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other aspect of that, of course, is that it has been also where that source lives in terms of things like source control and all those sorts of things as well, is that I see a lot of sites where, you know, the only copy of the source is inside some Power BI file, you know, and that's a bit scary too.
Yeah. One of the things that I think I'm most excited about with Fabric, and as we're now doing some project work with, mm-hmm. with larger customers, is that we can essentially build solutions like we have with Power BI.
Yep.
But we're able to take a lot of the heavy lifting. When it's important for it to scale, we can, you know, just like according to Roach's maxim, push it, you know, upstream as far mm-hmm. as possible. Now within the ecosystem, you have the ability to do that. You don't have yeah. to go knock on the DBA's door and say, hey, could you go write a stored procedure or a view that does this for mm-hmm. me, or build some transformation logic using a different tool. You know, we can do that within a separate set of within a, a, a unified tool, mm-hmm. and a unified experience. I think that's the good news, and that is good news.
Yeah.
But there's also the opportunity for perhaps less qualified technologists mm-hmm. to use one tool to do some really crazy things and shoot themselves in the yeah. foot.
Look, so
with that power comes responsibility.
We should mention the fact that there are sort of really two warehousing type experiences in there. And I mean, one basically ends up dropping all the files in a data lake. And the other option, of course, is still a database that looks like the Synapse one, which I was never totally loving. But what's your take on, like, do you use both, or do you just do it all now with files, or do you do it all with a database?
That is the $64,000 question. Mm-hmm. And it depends.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the consulting answer. But I mean, seriously, I have conversations daily with our sales and pre-sales folks who are talking to customers who are saying, hey, we're interested in looking at Fabric. Can you come in and do a quick workshop, you know, show our developers how Fabric mm-hmm. works and what it's all about, and then recommend an architecture.
Yeah.
You know, we've worked with, you know, on-prem in the past, we've worked with Synapse Analytics, maybe we've worked with Databricks. Show us a diagram of a recommended architecture in Fabric that we can use to you know, put everything into that environment. And there isn't just one.
No, you know? Exactly.
Right. And I've, you know, I have several diagrams in Lucid, the diagramming tool that we use, where, you know, we show, okay, well, here's a medallion architecture mm-hmm. with three lake houses in a workspace.
Yeah.
And maybe in the...
And for those that don't know that, we should mention that's usually like a bronze, silver, gold, and mm-hmm. how would you describe progressively becoming more analytically useful as you get towards gold. Yep.
Right. Yeah, typically your raw or bronze layer is mm-hmm. is where you ingest your data and you don't manipulate it, and then yep. you start shaping and cleansing it in the silver layer, and then finally you typically would get to a dimensional schema in the gold layer. But you know, it so at that bronze layer, we might just use files.
Yeah.
That might just be your dumping ground for the CSV files and the JSON files and whatever format you're going to get your data from whatever the sources are. And, you know, whether that's just a folder in a lakehouse where you drop files or it's a separate lakehouse, I mean, it really depends on your needs.
In your case, does it also depend on where the source of the data is?
Well, I think very much so.
Hmm.
Sure.
Because one of the discussions I've had with Amir Netz endlessly is that just as a big picture, the idea of taking data that's well-structured, well-set in data types and things like that in a database, pulling it out to drop it in files to then go back and pick it up and try and turn it back into meaningful data, just as a big picture is a... I don't know.
It seems like you're taking a giant step backward.
Hi, this is Greg coming to you from another time and place. If you have a data-related project that needs to get off to a great start with the right architecture, or if you have an existing project that's off the rails, why not contact us? We help organizations of all sizes, from startups to tier one financials, and we can help you too. Check us out at sqldownunder.com. The other concern that I have that they never seem to talk about is the loss of precision and data typing and things like that every time you go from one of these to another one. You know, because the way things are stored and the data typing and all of those things are different in each of these environments.
I'll give you an example. I'm getting ready to teach a workshop in a week and a half in Vienna, a day-long pre-conference. And in the past, I've used an Azure SQL database. It's a copy of the Contoso DW sample database from Microsoft. And I thought, no, I'm going to put all of the data into Fabric, and then I'll have all of my students connect using the SQL endpoint, and we'll just call it SQL Server. We'll just say, just pretend like this is SQL Server, but it's really a lakehouse, and it's really being managed, you know, through the Spark engine. And I thought it would be a pretty simple thing to create a copy data action in pipelines and just transform data out of these tables, drop them into files, Parquet files in the lakehouse. And the problem that I encountered is that the money data type in SQL Server is interpreted as a decimal 3818.
Now, classic example, right?
Right. Why in the world does it default to that precision? I don't know. But the lakehouse will handle it just fine. You know, and if you actually look at the values, you can see all of these, you know, 0.00000018 times. And but the SQL endpoint can't handle that data type. So just because we can store it doesn't mean you can query it,
right? And but you see decimal's a classic example where if I look at we tend to avoid money as a data type in SQL Server, right? The only scenarios where I've ever had that where I felt I needed to use that was more where you know, the size of the data was an issue on absolutely gigantic files because it was sort of smaller than the equivalent decimal. But 99% of the time, we're using decimal instead. I always would say that the newbie mistake is to use float or real sort of thing for storing those things. But the thing that was always a challenge is then when I pick it up and I put it into Power BI, the decimal data type is actually a float, you know, and just straight away, that's a problem, right? But if I then add, I'm going to then take it and put it into files, and then I'm going to, where I've then got the Parquet data types, and then I'm going to translate that into a Power BI data type. Wow, you know, I just think you're opening yourself up for a bunch of entertainment.
Well, so what's going to happen inevitably is you're going to have some old SSRS report that is generated from an on-prem SQL Server database. You're going to take that same data, you're going to transform it, and then it'll show up in a Power BI report. And a consulting customer is going to look at the two reports and say, wait a second, we're 0.000003 off.
Your report does not add up.
Right, because of some rounding error or, you know, who knows.
I mean, that already happens with Power BI. We get pushback on the data types where you simply can't store the accuracy that people expect a column of numbers to add up. You know, and I mean, it's fine if you're talking about cents and what you're displaying is dollars, you know, or whole units of things, that's usually not a problem, but it's sure a problem, you know, if you have things showing in the case of US or Australian, like dollars and cents, and I don't know, you have six things that don't add up to the total. That's very hard to explain to a human who's looking at it. Right?
These are classic problems, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are just categorically, these are the same kinds of problems that we've been faced with for many, many years. And though I agree that, you know, this notion of starting with structured data and then storing it in an unstructured format, and then, you know, the task then is to evolve it into a more structured format. This is why we have jobs. We have to figure out efficient ways to do that. And we don't just use a certain pattern because, oh, we have a new tool and that's what they're telling us we should do. We need to be smart about these things.
But by the same token, we also have sources of data that are files, right? And so on. So, it isn't I think it's also, yeah, it's not necessarily one size fits all, but yeah, it's just, I've had a lot of discussions with people on the big picture idea of taking database data and making it not database data and then trying to make it database data again, you know, as conceptually. Actually, that does raise the thing about some of the things I am also wondering about is that, for example, in views, in analytic views, in a dimensional warehouse, we would normally have spaces and special characters in names of columns and things like that. Do you know where that's at? That's something I I've been meaning to check, but haven't yet, because I know Parquet under the covers does not support spaces and things like that. But what you can do is you can have in a delta table, you can have a column mapping. But, you know, this is the sort of stuff that makes me a bit nervous because, yeah, again, you start to get into some interesting complexities there. You know, like if you had a column mapping and you have a name in one place that maps to a different name somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, what does that then do to queries? And
I don't know the answer to this question off the top of my head. Now, I have built a lake house with structured tables and then created views over the top of that. In fact, I just using the SQL endpoint, used SQL Server Management Studio to create views.
Yeah.
I don't recall whether that style of view supports, sentence case naming conventions or sentence case column names. I'm going to assume that it does somehow. Because it's supposed to be at parity with SQL Server, with T-SQL.
If I look at T-SQL in SQL Database and I look at T-SQL in Synapse, like the Synapse was pretty much a subset, and the one in Fabric now is actually a subset of the Synapse one. So, you know, it would not actually surprise me if there are some challenges in amongst there. And it'll be interesting to see. But, they're the sort of things I get nervous about a little bit. Yeah, so.
In my experience, we typically, and, you know, coming from the Power BI world again, typically will convert the, you know, Pascal case more cryptic column names to sentence case with spaces and mixed case in Power Query, in Power BI.
Yeah, that's where we tend to differ. It's because we will tend to create a dimensional warehouse in Pascal case, for example, but then we'll have an analytic set of views that sit over that because we want them to be able to be used in Excel, to be used in, you know, if somebody does still have reporting services or Tableau or other things, we want those same names to then apply in all those places, not just in Power BI. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that is forever been a challenge. But it makes sense. And, you know, from a database design and standardization standpoint, I think it would make sense to use views as kind of that single version of the truth.
One thing that's always been missing with views, though, is as soon as you import views, you always lost the relationships because there's no way of representing relationships in the views. And so I've always thought I wish there was a way we could express a view that had details of the relationships between the views, right? So that when Power BI or Fabric was importing this stuff, schema-wise, it could know how to wire things up if it's coming from views. So, but anyway, yeah, that's a thing I would love to see in there somewhere. So.
there's always going to be one more thing that you know, that we would like to have as we get closer to utopia.
Yeah. How far have the projects you've been working on got at this point?
Most are in proof of concept.
That's good.
Stages. The typical asks that we're getting from customers is that they had invested in Synapse or they may be using Databricks, and they want to test the water. Cost is probably one of the biggest factors right now. Yeah. Hey, this looks like it might be cheaper if we move to fabric. So help us work through a proof of concept where we can test the water and make sure this thing's going to work for us. Mm-hmm. And working with a company that does a lot of data science and machine learning right now, and they had invested in some, you know, piecemeal Azure data platform capabilities, and you know, essentially saying, hey, you know, maybe we ought to just switch everything to fabric. You know, we'll engage in a proof of concept with this client so that they can better understand not only the data transformation and storage capabilities, but machine learning and data science. And the outcome of that might be that you still have richer capabilities within Azure than you do within Fabric. You know, the machine learning experiments.
As I said that with T-SQL, that's certainly the case. And actually, even with Data Factory, that still feels like that, where I could do more in ADF than I could in Synapse pipelines, and still, again, more than I can do in Fabric ones. But the beauty of the Fabric ones is that it just integrates so much more automatically when you're doing things in that environment. So,
yeah.
And again, you know, not nearly everything you go looking for is already there. It's more the edge cases. So,
You know, I was asked to put together a training workshop for a group of newer consultants, and we needed a new sample set of data. We wanted to use a healthcare set of data. And so I asked ChatGTP to generate Python code that would create 100,000 rows in a table that included patients' diagnoses, procedures, doctors, and some other things. And I also didn't want the data to be perfect because we needed to be able to transform and clean it up. And I said, give me 100 duplicate keys at random. So I asked ChatGTP to generate this Python script, which it did. It used a library called Faker, which was awesome. And I copied and pasted that code into a Fabric notebook. Output it to a lake house, use the SQL endpoint, and inside of 2 days, I had an entire training workshop.
Isn't that magnificent?
It was just beautiful.
I couldn't
do that with any other tool.
Yeah, no, Greg Nash, one of the local Melbourne guys here, did a number of sessions he does on his Friday Lunch and Learns, where he was sort of like using ChatGPT to help him build out Power BI models and things like that. The first thing that had me just rolling around laughing is he told it he was Australian, and it just started calling him mate and things. It was hilarious to watch. But the thing was, how quickly, two things amazed me. One is its understanding of acronyms, particularly industry acronyms. So like he picked a thing that was doing consignments and stuff and things like that. And there were things like DOTIF, and we're all looking at it going, and it just goes, that's delivery on time in full, you know, and things like, it just knew, of course, all of these acronyms and things that, particularly an analyst or somebody coming into this, you could just have it describe what are all these acronyms that the client is talking about, and it just knew them all, you know. But the other thing that amazed me, it was just like, let's get it to generate a whole bunch of sample rows with a table that has these columns, and it was phenomenal. The data that came back, and what impressed me more is I then said in Chinese, and I looked at the ones that came back, and they were brilliant. You know, like, I mean, the family names and things were common Chinese family names and so on. It's just unbelievable to look at, you know, like if you haven't started looking at these tools, if you haven't started looking at these tools, you really, really need to. You
know? All right. So I just, as we have been talking, I've opened SQL Server Management Studio, connected to a lake house, and recreated one of my views with spaces in the name. And it worked.
Excellent.
And I can
That's what we want to know.
There you go. So there's our answer. Yes.
Cool.
I'd love to look at the files
underneath and see how that all worked. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Yeah. Although the views are just metadata. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Yep.
No, cool. And so what are you, I suppose, yeah, we're getting towards time. It's just a case of, so what have you got coming up in the near future? Are you involved with any events or
yes.
people see you yes. somewhere or?
My next event is going to be the Vienna Data Days on mm-hmm. February 26th. I'm doing a full-day pre-conference, which is the thing that I'm actually using the Fabric Lakehouse as mm-hmm. the data source for. It's a building Power BI enterprise solutions. So my girl and I are flying to Frankfurt. I'm going to spend Tuesday yep. night speaking at Oliver Engel's user group mm-hmm. Over in Frankfurt am Main. And so we're driving through Heidelberg down to, through Bavaria to Vienna in January.
Outstanding. So
a little chilly, driving through the Alps, but then participating in that conference. And then essentially rinsing and repeating, I'm doing the same pre-conference for the Atlanta BI SQL Saturday, which is, mm-hmm. If memory serves, is February 9th. Anyway, that first weekend in
fairly
February.
Soon, yes.
Indeed. Yeah. And, of course, we got the MVP Summit coming up in March. Indeed.
Excellent. The only other one that I would mention while we're in this show is there's a really big push at the moment to get a large number of people certified on Fabric. And so
well, and people, just the Fabric exam, the DP
600 was yes.
just released yesterday.
Yeah. I think I'm allowed to say I was an author on that, so I have a pretty mm-hmm. good idea what's inside that. And
you just can't tell you
what questions. Yeah, so, but I would love to see a whole lot of people take that. It's in the beta stage at the moment, mm-hmm. But they're having a fairly short beta for this. And so they want to get it into market, I think, pretty soon. But there are a whole lot of other things you can do in association with that. So there are cloud challenges that people can still take in relation to that. There's a thing called something like Learn It in 30 Days or 30 Days to Learn It. But if you look up Fabric and then 30 Days or whatever, that will point at a slightly more comprehensive challenge. I found that had additional stuff on Activator and so on that wasn't in the first one. And so the other thing coming up is there's a whole lot of what they call Learn It Live or Learn Live, which are sessions that the MVPs are all delivering on particular parts of the learning path for Fabric. So if you want to have an easier learning path, I mean, you could just assign and sit and let a couple of the MVPs wander you through each of the modules and get good background on that too. So look, I just encourage people to get out and get involved in that one.
I'm very impressed at just how much effort the Microsoft product teams are putting into providing educational resources.
Yeah.
And, you know, working with the MVP community and other professionals, but it is just so easy to find very, very rich and up-to-date content.
Oh, yeah. There's so many. There are exam cram things, which I can't take part in, but there are also things like learning rooms. There's just a wealth of stuff coming.
Another event I wanted to mention was the Power BI and Fabric Summit, which
of course,
Radicad have promoted and have run in the past. We just wanted to mention that we lost Layla Itati, and please support them by signing up for the Power BI and Fabric Summit. That's coming up the second week of February, the 12th through the 16th. Mm-hmm. I will be
awesome.
Speaking.
Well, thank you so very much for your time today, Paul.
Well, Greg, thank you again for the invitation. It's always a pleasure. It's we've known each other for years now, and mm-hmm. I've always enjoyed my interactions with you.
Awesome. Thanks.
All right.